The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
Sunny skies, welcome to this Thursday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up in just a moment.
These days, I'm still receiving death threats. I'm still receiving, you know, a significant amount of hate mail and things like that. But I feel protected.
That conversation with Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Khan Cullors. We'll talk about misconceptions about the movement and why she's adapting her New York Times bestseller, When They Call You a Terrorist, to a young adult reader version. But first this, Georgia Supreme Court Chief Justice Harold Melton says the court's in order. He plans to sign an order lifting the suspension of jury trials this Saturday. Now, Georgia courts will be permitted to hold jury trials if they've done some things like reconfigure courtroom seating and installing plexiglass dividers and ventilation systems. Mask and social distancing will also be required. Because it takes some time to assemble juries, officials say it could take another month or more before jury trials officially resume. And that leads us into our daily update on the coronavirus here in Georgia. The latest figures from the Georgia Department of Public Health indicate the number of COVID-19 cases confirmed each day has remained steady for more than a week. Now, to be exact, 326,142 COVID-19 cases have been confirmed here in the state. And then there's this, the percentage of diagnostic tests that return positive results, well, that also hasn't moved that much in the past week. In total, 29,308 have been hospitalized. Of those, 5,439 were ICU admissions. And while the pandemic here in Georgia has slowed considerably since the summer peak, many key metrics are far above where they were before Governor Brian Kemp issued a shelter-in-place order in the spring. So now here in Georgia, in total, 7,259 deaths have been recorded since March. And as always, we bring this information based on the State Department of Public Health. This is Closer Look. Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. The phrasing has become global. These words that first appeared as a hashtag on Twitter. And now those words are a movement, an organization, a rallying call for racial and social justice. It's also been criticized, vilified, and called a terrorist organization. Black Lives Matter. For Patrice Khan Cullors and Asha Bandale, they could probably write a lot more than what they have individually and together, including the 2018 release of When They Call You a Terrorist, A Story of Black Lives Matter, and The Power to Change the World. It will become a New York Best Time seller. Well, it's now being adapted into a young adult audience. And joining me now to talk more about this release is Patrice Khan Cullors. She's just more than a co-founder of Black Lives Matter. She's an artist. She's an organizer. She's freedom fighter from Los Angeles, she says. And she's also a performance artist and Fulbright scholar. Patrice Khan Cullors, good to talk to you again. This is our, what, third time in conversation?
This is our third time in conversation. It's so good to talk to you. It's so good to hear your voice. So grateful for you.
2 years ago on a visit to Atlanta when we were in conversation at the Carter Center, and you talked about what life had been like, what life had developed into for you with Black Lives Matter. And I remember when you spoke of death threats and you talked about the mental toll. And I want to start with that because I want to talk about how you're doing now, you know, from that first time when Black Lives Matter first appeared across Twitter and everything that it's evolved into. How are you doing?
You know, I've learned so much in the last 7 years, and I have learned how much support I need in moments like this when there's a moment of uprising and many of us are being called to be more visible and, you know, stand and rise in the front lines. And so these days, I'm still receiving death threats. I'm still receiving, you know, a significant amount of hate mail and things like that. But I feel protected, and I feel like I have a really solid, strong team, and there's more people who are rooting for us than there are people who are trying to undermine us, demonize us, and call for our death.
We also talked about self-care. When you're an activist, when you're trying to do this work, you talked about the struggle in that. How are you doing on that front?
Oh my goodness, you're going to be so proud of me. I'm doing so much better. It's a daily, you know, it's a daily practice to take care of yourself and to, you know, really ensure that my health is the number one priority. I'm in therapy. I'm looking into doing yoga. I'm not the biggest fan of yoga practice. So I'm really looking into like a new, you know, physical health practice. And I've been going to chiropractor. I went back to chiropractor once they opened up. Have a lot of, you know, chronic pain. So I feel like I'm doing some solid work to keep myself healthy, not just for the world, but for myself. So I have a good quality of life.
Through your lens, Patrice, what has been the biggest or the most, through your lens, damaging untruth about Black Lives Matter that's still being disseminated?
Oh, man. That we're trying to destroy the country. I think that's the most damaging, because basically what we've seen the right and white supremacists do is create a narrative that Black Lives Matter, the organization in particular, because we have to remember Black Lives Matter shares the same name as the organization. So if you've seen on the media, what they're doing is, you know, we believe, you know, you can believe in the movement and what it stands for, but don't support the organization. That's the way the right is trying to shape it, because they know we have such strong support. And so I've been really, you know, wanting to push people to understand that the movement and the organization, let me say that differently, that the organization supports the movement. There's no way you can have a movement without organizations. Let's think about the civil rights movement. SCLC, which was Dr. Martin Luther King's organization, was a power player of that movement. SNCC, power player of that movement. So we can't disconnect organizations from movements, and we have to challenge the misinformation, disinformation, especially the talking point that we are trying to destroy the country.
Are you all anti-police?
I'm going to say it. I'm going to respond in this way. We are not anti-safety or anti-accountability. We don't believe the current structure of policing actually gets us closer to safety. We think the current structure of policing doesn't prevent crime. It only intervenes on it. And we know for a fact that Black people suffer greatly at the hands of police. So of course they don't keep us safe. So I will say we are anti the current police structure, but that does not mean that we don't believe in safety or accountability.
In a year, and what a year it's been, giants of the civil rights movement passing. Now we're in the midst of this modern day movement. We've had conversations before about this generation of social activists, but what do you notice about this generation now in this moment? Because the outrage and outcry is still all too familiar from what John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis, C.T. Vivian, you know, all those folks were still fighting for. But what's different with this generation of social activists?
I don't know if there's a difference. I think every generation has a crew of activists and especially young people who decide to take to the streets, who decide that their constitutional right of protesting is the necessary move to get us closer to freedom. And so I don't want to separate, you know, this generation from my generation or the last generation. I will say that, you know, I'll say that we have social media, mm-hmm. and that really does change the nature of protests and the nature of getting your voice heard, because it really, social media democratizes who's able to talk. We're not relying on traditional media to have a conversation about our lives. And I think, you know, for the younger generation who's younger than me, younger millennials and Gen Zers, they have lived through Black Lives Matter, the Women's March, March for Our Lives, the Me Too movement. And so they are well versed in movement and mm-hmm. organizing and activism. It's really a part of their makeup. And that wasn't true for me. When I was 16, 17, I was politicized. I was learning about all these things like racism and sexism, homophobia, but that wasn't the whole world. Mm-hmm. The whole world wasn't in an uprising and challenging social norms. So this generation gets to grow up and challenge everything that was taught that was normal. They get to challenge that, and that's so powerful. And they get to create a new vision and a new imagination around how we move forward.
Is that also part of the origin behind the idea to adapt when they call you a terrorist into a young adult version?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The minute we wrote the adult version of the book, we knew we wanted to adapt it into a YA book. We knew that younger folks were going to need to take this book and have it as a tool for their own development. I was a 16-year-old activist. I read everything I could get my hands on. Every single book, Audre Lorde, bell hooks, Toni Morrison. Mm-hmm. I was in it, Maya Angelou. I needed to read every poem written by Black people, every novel, every memoir. You know, I needed that for my own, you know, my own development. And so I wanted to create a book that also gave young people more access to me. I can't sit with every single one, mm-hmm. and gave them more access to how activism and organizing can work for them.
In fact, throughout the book, the reader, I don't want to give too much away, the reader is asked questions. For example, how have you experienced loss in your life? How has the heartache of loss changed you? How have you rebounded from loss? Why are these self-reflecting questions so important for the reader in this version?
You know, every chapter is jam-packed with so much. Every chapter sort of goes into, you know, the history of policing, mm-hmm. the history of a divested community, the history of a family trying to be present for, you know, this moment, the moments that they're living in the 80s and 90s. You know, this book really does try to paint a picture of what it felt like, what it was like to live under police occupation, and providing reader questions for each chapter just gives people time to reflect mm-hmm. and think about their own lives. And, you know, some of the readers are going to be like, oh my God, this is what I've lived. And some of the readers are going to be like, I've never heard about any of these things in my entire life because of their power and privilege.
Are some of these questions that a young Patrice Concolors couldn't answer or could answer at that same age that this book is intended for, you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I would have loved to have a book with reader questions. Like, I think about, you know, Elaine Brown's Taste of Power, mm-hmm. or Assata Shakur's book, like having reader questions and having just an intentional YA presence in those books, even though I read them as a young adult, they would have gone a long way for me.
I remember reading When and Where I Entered, The Impact of Black Women in America, and thinking about, you know, what questions could I have answered upon reading that book. Pretty fascinating. Pretty interesting when you try to come up with what you think you would have responded with.
You know.
Did you seek the critique of some young folks to say, look, this is what we're coming out with now? And, you know, young folks, they're very candid and honest. Did you seek some input from them?
Yeah, absolutely. I have some young Gen Zers in my life who I adore, and you know, who read the adult version. A lot of young people have, mm-hmm. without the actual you know, reader questions or the images or the other enhancement I made to the book. And one of the things that folks wanted were pictures.
Man, I tell you, you were so cute with your little pigtails. The pigtails, I don't know where they came from, but we all had them, right?
Every single black girl, tell the truth.
Did you get your hair pressed?
Oh, every single 2 weeks until I decided to shave my head when I was 17 years old and my mom lost it.
Really?
Yes.
Did she retire the hot comb from the stove?
Oh my goodness. Is there a picture in there of me get my hair pressed? Because I should have put it in there.
No, but I know.
We had a hairdresser who would come over every 2 weeks and do all three of our hair. I have a little sister, my mom, and I, and she would sit in the kitchen with the hot comb on the stove. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know that I'm not going to, if I ever have a child who wants to get their hair pressed, I will never subject them to this practice, because it's literally
scarring.
I don't want to put my mom out there like that, but it's how many
scarring.
Times did that hot comb get too close to your scalp?
Hold your ear. You like, look, woman, you have a hot comb to the back of my neck. You talking about hold your ear.
Every 2 weeks. And I just remember, I hated getting my hair done. I'm tender headed. And I just remember becoming politicized, reading, you know, books from bell hooks and so many other folks, and realizing this isn't for me. This doesn't work. I don't like how I feel. Like, mm-hmm. what about my natural? I first started wearing my natural hair in high school, mm. before it was cool to wear your natural hair. And my hairdresser, I remember saying to her, I'm not getting my hair pressed anymore. I want you to work on my natural hair. And she really like helped me and figure that out. And then I shaved my head. I first cut it really short. I just cut it with some scissors, so some tabletop scissors. And then I shaved it one day. I went to a barbershop and I shaved it bald.
How important are the images though? Because it helps the reader. Some more insight into you. You can read the words on the page, but then you look at the pictures.
There's something really important about being able to see a person in their childhood as they're talking about it, being able to see what is important, what was important to them, being able to get parts of their lives through a picture. A picture is so powerful and speaks so profoundly. So I thought it was really important to share that.
Patrice, what's next for you? I know you're involved in a lot. What's the next chapter for you like?
You know, y'all are gonna find out in the next couple weeks that I'm going to be entering more intimately into the TV film space. And I'm excited to have a new medium to share stories with the world, stories about organizers and Black folks and Brown folks and the work of activists. There hasn't been enough narrative, full narrative of people who are on the front lines, who are activists, who are organizers, who are advocates. And so you know, folks will see that there's an exciting, some exciting new ventures in the TV film space for me.
So we'll find out in the next couple of weeks. You don't want to give, drop some knowledge, drop a, some breaking
news. Can't tell
news.
You yet. Can't tell you yet.
It's called When They Call You a Terrorist, a story of Black Lives Matter and the power to change the world, now adapted for YA young adult readers, from Patrice Kahn Cullors, co-founder of Black Lives Matter, and so much more. Patrice, as always, thank you for taking the time. Good conversation.
Oh, thank you so much. I know. I feel like we're friends now, so we get to just giggle and laugh about a bunch of things.
Well, I don't know how our mothers and aunts are going to feel about the segment of us getting our hair pressed. We might not be invited to the next family gathering.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. From Fortune 500 companies all the way down to mom and pop shops, they're all dealing with the impact of COVID-19. And we know research suggests that minority-owned businesses are being hit the hardest. And now there's a new effort to help small, minority, and women-owned businesses during this global health crisis. Take a listen to this.
Truist Financial Corp, as we looked at, you know, we provided a lot of investments from our foundation as a result of the pandemic. And one of the things that kept bubbling to the surface was the need to support small businesses. And small businesses, as we know, are a cornerstone of our community.
A cornerstone of our community. Now, that's Lynette Bell, president of the Truist Foundation, talking about the foundation's mission to help small businesses during this pandemic. And the foundation recently donated $40 million to create Corner Square Community Capital. It's a new national nonprofit fund that will support selected community-developed financial institutions. We also know them as CDFIs, and that will help small business owners sustain and advance their business. But there's a lot more we need to know. So joining me now to talk about all this and how the program will work is Patrick Woody. He's president of the NC Rural Center, as Corner Square is a subsidiary of that. And Martina Edwards, chief of strategic partnerships at Access to Capital for Entrepreneurs, also known as ACE. They've been on this program so many times, I have to send everyone over there a shirt or a mug. Patrick and Martina, thanks for taking the time. Patrick, I'll get you a mug too. Don't worry, buddy.
That sounds great, Rose. Thank
you. Good morning. Yeah, thank you. It's great to be back.
All right. You know, when we've had these conversations before about how can small businesses sustain, get through the pandemic. But I heard a report just earlier this week on Marketplace here on NPR that, look, a lot of these small businesses, if they haven't closed, they're going to close and they won't come back. It's going to be really hard. So, Martina, I'll start with you. The moment that we're in with this pandemic, it's extraordinary, but what fears do you have about the plight of the small business person during all this?
Yeah, we are, you know, very concerned. I think, you know, nationally, a report came out, like you said, that 40% of Black businesses had closed. And in the state of Georgia alone, the Office of SBA of Advocacy says that 43% of the private workforce is employed by small businesses, right? So there are a lot of kinks in the armor, and we know that it's really important to try to undergird the small businesses. And we've been focusing on relief, recovery, and reinvention. So for ACE, has been around for 20 years. We're the largest small business focused CDFI in the state of Georgia. And we have really been focused on giving folks a chance when others can't or won't, right? Through capital, coaching, and connections. Mm-hmm. And this opportunity with Truist is phenomenal in terms of a partnership, because it's going to allow us to continue to propel that forward in terms of giving those folks the capital that they need, but also the business advisory to start pivoting their businesses.
And we'll dig into that a little bit more. But Patrick Woody, your assessment on the plight of the small businesses during all of this?
We've been working statewide in North Carolina with a partnership of 8 CDFIs to deliver relief to businesses impacted by the pandemic. And it's everybody. But we are particularly concerned about businesses that are owned by minorities, women, people of color, and in our low to moderate income census tracts across our state and across the entire Southeast. No question but what they've been impacted time will tell how many can bounce back and reinvent and reimagine themselves and come back. I think some will, some won't. So the timing has never been more important for us to really focus attention on these small businesses that are owned by women, by African-American small business owners, Latino small business owners, and really make sure that they're being served from a capital standpoint, coaching, connection. Those three C's are incredibly important to the work that ACE does and CDFIs across the Southeast.
Well, Patrick, let's look at some specific industries. We know that the restaurant industry, obviously the landscape of that is changing. But through your assessment, are there any other particular businesses as it relates to small businesses, maybe small boutiques, that you all are extremely worried about as well?
Yeah, we've seen, as we've worked with businesses of all types across our state, that it's particularly retail. It is travel and tourism related businesses, accommodations, restaurants, those types of businesses, any kind of service industry, which requires, one-on-one contact with a lot of people. Those are the, over 60% of the demand for our COVID response program in North Carolina have been to businesses in those sectors.
Hmm. Martin, you want to add anything to that about what specific industries that are concerning for you all?
Absolutely. I would agree with Patrick. There are a lot of hard hit sectors, tourism, the retail industry, hospitality in particular. Event spaces aren't really able to do much. Restaurants and childcare have faced extraordinary challenges as some of those temporary layoffs or furloughs and closures are turning permanent. I know that for us, ACE has been focused on standing in the gap to ensure that those small businesses have, equitable resources to survive, recover, and thrive. I would say that, this partnership is allowing us to continue to move our work forward. And in 2020 alone, we have seen so much demand. We've seen done 400% more affordable loans this year than we did in 2019 for the year. And that's helped to supply about 15.5 million in business loans to businesses that many were on the brink. And then there are others, right, that have, I would say, COVID defensive businesses. So they needed additional capital to help propel them forward and catalyze that growth, but in line with our ethos, right? 80% of that capital has actually gone to entrepreneurs of color and women, which, as was mentioned earlier, have always kind of been disproportionately impacted with these barriers to capital.
Before we dig into, we're going to dig into this new foundation, but now, given what you all have just said, now it's more than ever, it's important to have these public and private partnerships for the small business owners. And Martina, if you could just take that and take it further from me, because without these type of strategic partnerships, then what resources would there be for small business owners?
You're absolutely right. I mean, at this point in time, we have to come together. Small businesses, I've always said, create collective prosperity, right? It's not just the business owner. It's our 20th year anniversary, and our theme has been the ripple effect. Invest in one, impact many. And so if you think about helping someone to realize their dream of opening a business, they're then able to hire employees. Those employees get income that helps their families. And we know that a financially stable home is really important for thriving children. And so as we look at what's going on with the cascading health crisis and, the ballooning economic downturn, it is really impacting those families, and they're really in danger, right? So it's important for us to have this partnership to amplify and complement the work that we have already been doing, trying to help these businesses shift. A great example is of a woman named Amelia Guild, who had a transportation service working with getting students home or to different places after school. Of course, in March, her business came to a halt, but for our partnership with a separate grant from Truist that was really focused on business preservation, we were able to provide her with 3 months of debt payment relief, right? So that she could focus on reinventing herself, pivoting her strategy, getting a diversity supplier certification, and now she is a preferred vendor for Atlanta Child Care Services. So she's able to get a new contract and help essential workers with their kids, right? So that's critical in terms of what we do when we couple that capital with business advisory. That's an example of how this is effective, and it will continue to support businesses. 92% of them, based on surveys, are having to pivot their business model.
Patrick Woody, the importance of public and private partnerships to help small business owners.
And that's really the whole reason behind the creation of Corner Square Community Capital, and with the support of Truist Bank, and we will be eternally grateful for the investment Truist is making in CDFIs in the Southeast United States, actually a 17-state region. We're starting a program that we intend to be evergreen, that will last in perpetuity and support the excellent work of organizations like ACE and the I love the profile, the personal story that Martina just told about one of their customers, because at the end of the day, that is why we do what we do. That's what it's all about. And we perfected over 3 decades of working just within the borders of our own state, programs that really help leverage and build the capacity of CDFIs. And that's our goal here, is really to go out across a very broad footprint and really invest in the long-term capacity building of the CDFI industry, because we know CDFIs are going to disproportionately be better positioned and better able, and are going to target their work and their assistance to people of color, to women-owned businesses. Incredibly important, something we care deeply about. We're going to be able to support more startups and help more startups be successful in the long run. Through this program, and by really helping to invest in the long-term capacity of CDFIs to help ACE and Martina and her crew do more to meet the needs of those small business owners and their footprint.
So let's take this tier by tier. So we have the Corner Square Community Capital, which Truist is funding with the $40 million. And then you all come in and distribute that money to the CDFIs like ACE.
The way it'll actually work is we've announced so far 6 CDFIs that will be partners in this Corner Square effort, ACE being one of them. Corner Square will purchase 25% participations in the loans that ACE makes. That does a couple of things. It helps take away some of the risk that ACE is doing it takes on by doing this type of lending. So it helps de-risk their total portfolio. It also allows them to take 25% of their capital and plow it back into more loans to more businesses in the area that they serve.
And I want to be clear, this will be in the form of a loan and not a grant for these small businesses. It'll be a loan.
Yeah, it's us really co-investing with these CDFIs. We're purchasing 25% of the loans that they do and leveraging their capital to do more. And the thing we like about this model, and I think the thing that really attracted Truist, is that it is evergreen. This is work we can continue to do as the years unfold and as we go forward and as we grow the capacity of the CDFI industry to meet the needs of more small business owners.
So, Martina, let's get over to what you all are going to be doing at ACE, which again stands for Access to Capital for Entrepreneurs. With this money, it's more than just providing the loan for the small business owner, but you also mentioned giving them resources to either help reimagine or reinvent their business, or also helping them with some other initiative. What are some of the options here?
Absolutely. Basically, we're providing access to capital, but also we have known that the critical formula has been coupling that with technical advisory, business advisory services. So ACE is going to go out and continue to do what we have been doing for the past 20 years, you know, around our mission of helping to move capital to underserved people and places. But our vision is also around, you know, closing wealth gaps and trying to support these, lessen these economic disparities that are out there. I think that this funding from Truist is actually not only timely, as Patrick mentioned, but I love the intentionality around it. And we've been really intentional about focusing on racially and ethnically diverse groups, as well as women, to try to create some gender and equity around access to capital for these businesses. In the Southeast, there are about a little over 1,000 CDFIs in the nation, but the Southeast actually has the fewest amount of CDFIs anywhere in the country. So I think in terms of this being evergreen as a way to strengthen the CDFI industry, we serve, to me, as the ancillary components of the banking industry. We're a needed component, and we have a vested interest in really moving things forward. And if we can strengthen small businesses who employ so many Georgians, then we will actually help to strengthen our Georgia's economy as well. So we're excited about continuing to move forward with that work.
And someone listening probably wondering, well, do you already have to be involved with ACE? I'm a small business owner. I'm in Brookhaven. I love this whole project, but I have never worked with you all. What are the chances that they could get in on the action, so to speak?
Right. Well, you know, we serve 68 counties, all of the metro area and North Georgia. So as long as you're a part of our service area, this is really helping to, we've been doing a lot of emergency loans. We did paycheck protection loans after round one, when so many small businesses and solo entrepreneurs in particular were really shut out of that process. And this is allowing us to get back to opening up our doors, you know, being open for business on a greater scale, because as was mentioned, Truist, this fund will help to share in the risk of these small businesses. So yes, people can come, and just like anything else, we'll evaluate their strategies and what they're trying to do, and the credit team will do their work around that.
If I could just add real quickly, we're really excited about the fact that the way this program model works, it will be supporting the lending, not only the current lending that ACE is doing, but the future lending that ACE is going to be doing. And that's the really exciting thing, I think.
As we wrap up, and Patrick, I'll start with you. If not for this type of program, you all talked about the importance of public-private partnerships and the importance of having resources for small business owners. But with this resource, with folks having access to capital, the outcomes, let's get to the positive outcomes here. What are you hoping comes out of this?
Martina had said something that was very important, and that is that the Southeast tends to lag the rest of the country in the strength of our CDFI industry. What I think is incredibly important is this program will invest in building the greater capacity of these CDFIs. What we know, and particularly coming out of this pandemic, CDFIs are going to be more important than they have ever been to small business owners and people hoping to start a small business. You know, many businesses, as they start in that startup mode, they can't go to a bank to borrow money through a traditional banking situation. It requires a third-party capital access resource that really are our CDFIs. Mm-hmm. So what excites me is we're setting ourselves up to grow this industry at a time when this industry has never been more important to the small business landscape of the Southeast.
Martina, I'll give you the last word.
Thank you. You know, I would just say, as our nation is really facing a barrage of factors, from social unrest to health uncertainty, you know, institutionalized and systemic barriers and policies that have really disenfranchised minority groups and women. We are just excited to be able to use this as a lever to continue to amplify the work that we do. And from an outcomes perspective, we will continue to deploy capital that is going to support the businesses. And I think at the end of the day, that's what we're most excited about. There has never been a time in our 20-year history where we have felt like the work that we're doing is more important than it is today.
The Truist Foundation donating $40 million to create Corner Square Community Capital. That's a new national nonprofit fund that will support selected community development financial institutions. They call them CDFIs. ACE is one of those, which is Access to Capital for Entrepreneurs. I've been speaking with Patrick Woody, president of the North Carolina Rural Center, as Corner Square is a subsidiary of that, and Martina Edwards, chief of strategic partnerships at ACE. Thank you both for taking the time. Thank you both for being able to help small business owners here in Georgia.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rose.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. We know the COVID-19 pandemic has led so many of us, millions of us, to work from home. But this has also some unintended consequences. Experts in this area say the more and more we're all online conducting business or learning, this can lead to a rise in cyber attacks. Last week, the U.S. Treasury Department issued two warnings against cybercrime, and these warnings were issued on the first day of National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. Now, Atlanta, of course, has its own experiences with cyber attacks, even prior to the pandemic. It's one of several cities where local governments, school systems have been targeted and disabled by hackers in the past few years. So, we always ask this question, what can be done to prevent this? And we usually get the same answer. You really can't prevent it. You just have to know how to manage it and maybe try to prevent it. Well, here, the Georgia Institute of Technology, Georgia Tech, recently started an entire school dedicated to answering this question and a lot more. Georgia Tech has plans to launch the School of Cybersecurity and Privacy and is led by Interim Chair Richard DeMillo. Professor, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Hi, Rose. Thank you.
You know, I appreciate this is a very important topic. Even before this pandemic, here's what I had read were the major top cybersecurity threats that organizations were going to face in 2020. Cloud vulnerability, AI-enhanced cyber threats, something called AI fuzzing, machine learning poisoning, smart contract hacking, social engineering attacks, deep fake. I know maybe two of those based on the terms, but someone listening says, wow, that's a lot. How far have we come in this nation through your lens in being able to, I'm not going to say stop, because you told me once before you cannot stop these cyber attacks. You have to be able to manage them and then be able to work through some of them. How far has this nation come?
So that's exactly right, Rose. There's no point in saying we're going to get over the risks that we have from digital technology. And I think you framed it exactly right. So as we as a society have moved to transform our lives digitally, and we're doing it right now in the middle of a pandemic, you know, we're going to be met with challenges. And some of the challenges have to do with the fact that we have assets that are floating around the network. We have computers that monitor our bank accounts. We conduct business online, and there's always someone that wants to profit from that. So the list of vulnerabilities that you mentioned kind of makes me think of a Walmart. So when you walk into Target or a Walmart, you see all these shelves filled with products, and that's the way the online world is too. There are folks out there that go to essentially retail websites to download software packages that allow them to invade your systems, to invade your computers. Hmm. Sometimes it's on a big scale, a national scale. Sometimes it's on a small scale, the scale of an individual. But we have to adapt to that. Just the same way we adapt to all the other risks in life these days, we have to be aware, we have to understand enough about what we're doing to conduct ourselves safely.
So, based on everything that we've just said so far, and we've scared a lot of people, because that's what we tend to do when you have these type of segments, these incidents, though, seem to indicate, all right, there's a growing need for a workforce that's trained, we're not going to say at preventing, but dealing with these cyber attacks. And I imagine that's what's led to the founding of this new school at Georgia Tech.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, we built on 20 years of investment in cybersecurity, going all the way back to the first Sam Nunn forum when we started talking about online banking in the middle 90s, mm-hmm. To today when we have cloud computing and all the things that we didn't really even dream of back then. So Georgia Tech has built up a base of expertise that's really kind of unrivaled in the industry. In fact, we just were ranked in undergraduate programs by U.S. News and World Report. Not that we chase those kinds of rankings, mm-hmm. but it's really nice when someone says, well, all that investment that you've made has really paid off for us.
Now, there's actually a shortage of folks in this area. trained in cybersecurity. There's a 2019 cybersecurity workforce study that found the U.S. workforce is facing, and this number just, it blew my mind, facing a shortage of more than 498,000 workers in this area.
Yeah, so this is one of the rationales for forming the school. We know that the workforce has shifted over the last 10 years, and what used to be a niche area of computer engineering or computer science, or maybe something that a lawyer or a public policy person would study in their spare time, has turned into a career path. And so we're seeing students at all ages, high school students coming for first year, people with degrees coming back for professional education, even the public that wants continuing education and awareness training, coming back to us with career paths that are specifically aimed at cybersecurity. And our challenge, I think, is to figure out how to blend that kind of education, which is a non-standard kind of education, into the traditional experience that you would get with a Georgia Tech mm-hmm. degree. We're gonna do that by having a very innovative school that spans all of Georgia Tech, reflects the institutional commitment that Georgia Tech has made to this, and has the intellectual diversity, I think, to meet that challenge.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Richard DeMillo. He currently serves as the interim chair of Georgia Tech's new School of Cybersecurity and Privacy. And Professor, someone listening is saying, so will someone be able to get a degree in cybersecurity and privacy?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we will do is figure out how to weave cybersecurity and privacy and safety into a lot of curricula at Georgia Tech. So engineers design things. They design manufacturing systems, and they have supply chains, and the supply chains are vulnerable to attack. And so when you think about what does it take to have a supply chain be secure, it has to be a supply chain with integrity, something that someone can't sneak a foreign chip or a listening device into a computer that's not supposed to have one. And those kinds of problems, I think, are the things that are going to attract people to this aspect of engineering and computer science at Georgia Tech. And we'll see this, I think, essentially right away, because we have a backlog of students since the announcement was made 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. We have a backlog of students that have said, how do I get into the program? How do I get a degree? Undergraduate wow. degree, sometimes it's a minor, sometimes it's professional education and certification.
Wow. Well, let me ask you this then. With that interest, and then going back to that number I read about the shortage of workers in this industry, what about your faculty and staff? Where will you recruit them from, or do you have enough right there on campus to get started?
We have a critical mass of faculty and research staff between the academic side of Georgia Tech and the Georgia Tech Research Institute, which does sponsored research to get this program going. But to be honest, we need the Atlanta area to step up. So Atlanta has become a hub of innovation in cybersecurity. And we plan on building on that. We plan on involving industrial partners and government decision makers in the way that we design the program. They will teach when called on to teach in the program. And we're going to monitor how well our graduates do once they leave Georgia Tech, and feed that back to the curriculum designers so we can continue to update the programs.
Professor, is there another School of Cybersecurity and Privacy at another institution that you all are borrowing or looking at their curriculum that you're going to implement over at Tech?
So we're going to kind of blend together a lot of what I think are good ideas. You see bits and pieces of this vision at other institutions. Mm-hmm. In Augusta, next to Fort Gordon, the cyber school has done a really good job at interacting with their clients at Fort Gordon, and we have experience from 20 years ago when I was a dean at Georgia Tech in blending different interdisciplinary programs into a single unified coherent undergraduate program. So we're going to take ideas like that and put them together so that the student gets what we think is a unique experience.
Now, I got to ask you, Professor, will voting and election security be part of this school?
Ah, you bring up my favorite
I'm just wondering, there might be some concerns.
So we will take the charge of a public university to engage in public dialogue very seriously. And part of what we will do, and you know, we've had this conversation in the past. Part of what we'll do is raise awareness across all kinds of industries, voting and democratic processes being one of them. But not because, to get back to where we started this, not because we think there's any silver bullet that's going to fix these problems, but because the awareness of the public as to what risks are going to be exposed by incorporating technology into these processes is something that deserves public discussion.
By the way, Professor, for you and our listeners, speaking of security, on tomorrow's program, a conversation with former CIA Director John Brennan, who, of course, knows a whole lot about all of that. So get him to come in and be a guest lecturer or something. I don't know.
Yes, absolutely.
Listen, as we talk about the importance of this new school of cybersecurity and privacy, and you've already said that there's a lot of interest, are you also going to make sure it can be as diverse as possible in terms of not only just the students, but the faculty as well?
Yes, we have built into the plans for this school maybe the most ambitious, diverse faculty and training force possible, all the way from programs that we use to get high school kids into Georgia Tech courses and training pathways early, to the centers like the Constellation Center, which specifically aims at bringing underrepresented minorities into Georgia Tech. We are currently the largest producer of minority engineers and computer scientists in the country, and we plan on building on that. Atlanta is a great platform to do this. I mean, there are so many wonderful institutions in the metro area that doing something stovepipe just for the North Avenue campus is less appealing to us than broadening out and pulling as many voices into the discussion as possible.
You all have launched. What's next? When will students start taking classes? And start being able to sign up, rather, to take classes.
Well, they're taking classes right now.
Oh, they're already in it
right now. We're kind of moving the parts around as the boat is sailing. And part of my job is to take all of these dozens of researchers and professors who have an interest in cybersecurity and figuring out how we can shift them into the program and into the school in a way that doesn't cause a lot of disruption for the classes that are currently going on.
And finally, we'll end with you. Currently, you have the tag of interim chair. I imagine you'd like to see that be permanent.
I'm at the other end of my career, Rose. So my job is to get the get the school launched and get it on the right track into to recruit a young permanent chair who can take this school for the next 20 years.
Nobody's really ever at the end of their career, Professor.
I know. My wife keeps telling me that. When are you going to retire? Not anytime soon, apparently.
All right. Richard DeMillo, interim chair of Georgia Tech's new School of Cybersecurity and Privacy, a first. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Always good conversation and good information for our listeners.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you.
That's it for this edition of Closer Look, which is produced by Grace Walker and LaShawn Hudson. Our engineer is Shelley Canavy. If you missed any of today's program, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, you can listen to Closer Look weeknights at 8 p.m. and listen whenever you want, because Closer Look is now available as a podcast. Just visit NPR One or your favorite streaming app and subscribe. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.